they were saying when they think you cannot hear. If you understood what they do, if for you it was so clear. If you knew they shut down the factory in an economic ruse. If you could kiss the cheek of the child in the sweatshop that made your shoes. Every time we went to war to fight our evil foes, they told you we were really fighting for the good of CEOs. If you could feel the hunger of the many, see the riches of the few. If they told it like it is, what if you knew?
You're listening to Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. And Clearing the Fog is a project of popularresistance.org. You can subscribe to us on Apple, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Stitcher, and Google Play. You can also find Clearing the Fog at popularresistance.org. And while you're there, check out the Popular Resistance store. You'll find Clearing the Fog gear like water bottles, tote bags, t-shirts, and bumper stickers. We're also selling tickets to the Kevin Zeiss Emerging Activist Fund, which will be launched on October 28th. The first grant will be given in January of 2021 of $20,000, and the applications will begin to be accepted starting on October 28th through December 13th. So check that out at popularresistance.org. You can also subscribe to the Popular Resistance Daily Digest and weekly newsletter. Both are free. The Daily Digest provides you an email each morning with a summary of the articles that were posted the day before. And the newsletter is a weekly news analysis of what's happening in the United States and around the world. So check that out at popularresistance.org. This week, I interviewed Gabriel Rockhill. Gabriel is a philosopher, professor, author, and activist. He's at Villanova University, and he has written a series of four articles in Counterpunch and Black Agenda Report that talk about the history of fascism in the United States and around the world, how the current governance structure of liberal democracy and fascism both work hand in hand to support capitalism, and really provides an explanation of where we are and how we got there. It's a very interesting conversation, so I hope you'll stick around for that interview. Before that, I'd like to talk about some things that are in the news. I'll start with a COVID-19 update. The United States is approaching 9 million documented cases of COVID-19 and has passed 230,000 deaths. Currently, the number of new cases is rising in both the United States and the European Union. On October 23rd, there were more than 81,000 new cases in the United States, and over the past week, there have been nearly 500,000 new cases. 20 states are experiencing record levels of COVID-19 cases, and some of them are starting to really struggle to be able to deal with that. In El Paso, Texas, hospitals and ICUs are filling, and they're turning the convention center into a field hospital. They're also sending patients out to other hospitals in the area for care. In Wisconsin, the public health system is unable to keep up with the record number of cases each day, and they're not able to do the work of contacting each person who tests positive, finding out who they've been in touch with, and making sure that those people know that they've been exposed to someone who has COVID-19 and that they need to get tested and quarantine. Now, it's interesting that the greatest surges in COVID-19 cases is happening in red states and counties. I guess this is not really that much of a surprise if you look at the current administration's approach to COVID-19 and the example that they're setting. Vice President Mike Pence has had a number of staffers close to him test positive for COVID-19. And although it's been reported that Mike Pence is currently testing negative, he has been exposed and could test positive in the coming days, yet he continues to be out on the campaign trail holding large events, as is President Trump, and there's not a lot of mask wearing going on at these events. In fact, this week, Mark Meadows admitted basically defeat against the COVID-19 pandemic. Meadows said that they were not going to be able to stop the virus, but they could only work to mitigate it. So this, of course, is a conscious choice because there are countries around the world that have effectively stopped the virus. If we look at New Zealand and China as two excellent examples, also Vietnam, but there are others. And this was done through a real national strategy that put in place programs to educate people about how to protect themselves, provide them with what they need to protect themselves, have easy testing and a strong public health care infrastructure so that people can quarantine as well as adequate medical resources. And then, of course, there also needs to be financial support. If people are going to be able to quarantine properly, they need a financial support so that they can buy food, so that they don't lose their home, so that they don't have to work and can take care of their kids and help their children with online schooling and all these kinds of things. So that would be, you know, a nationally led, coordinated approach that we could use to try to stop the spread of this virus. That's not happening. Instead, what we're seeing is a patchwork approach where some states, some counties have certain policies, other states, other counties have other policies. And because people do travel between these areas without having a unified approach, it's very hard to contain the virus. Now, we're in kind of a third bump of the first wave of COVID-19. We haven't really gotten out of this first phase. We never went down low enough to say that we were out of the first phase. But, you know, I've often talked about the fact that COVID-19 or all infectious agents generally are spread exponentially. And if you look at the numbers of cases, it's really easy to demonstrate. So in the first bump of this phase, back in the winter, we were averaging around 25,000 new cases a day. The second bump over the summer, we saw about 50,000 new cases each day. And with this current bump, it is completely possible that we could be at a level of 100,000 new cases each day. Now, this is a serious situation because the virus that causes COVID-19 is, of course, a new virus, and we're still learning about it. And what we know is that while most people who have severe disease and die are people who have some sort of pre-existing condition, even young and healthy people can die from COVID-19. We're also learning about the long-term impacts of it and how even people with mild disease can then go on and suffer long-term consequences to their organs, such as their heart, lungs, liver, and their brain. It's also not known yet about the immunity to COVID-19 and whether people will develop a lasting immunity to it. Some people have already been documented to be reinfected. And when viruses are allowed to proliferate, they do mutate and change. And so we don't know how this virus could change. It could become worse. It could become more benign. We don't know the answer to that. And so it's always prudent to act out of caution and try to protect yourself and those around you by not catching COVID-19. So do what you can to stay physically distant from others. Wear a mask. A mask is not perfect, but it does help. And maintain excellent hygiene, particularly before you eat. So these are the things that we need to do because of the state is not able to do what it should be doing to prevent COVID-19. It's really up to us to take action and also to make the demands that the state does what it needs to do to support us during this. I'd like to talk about some good news. There's actually quite a bit of that right now, a number of recent victories that I'd like to highlight. And I'll start with the United Nations Nuclear Ban Treaty. The 50th country has ratified that treaty. That now means that it will go into effect 90 days from that ratification, which will be in January of 2021. The Nuclear Ban Treaty was voted on and passed by the United Nations in 2017, with 122 countries voting for it. None of the nuclear states participated in that. They just didn't participate in the negotiations of that treaty or in the vote on it. But what's interesting is that Iran did vote for it. And I think this is interesting because the narrative in the United States is that Iran wants to have nuclear weapons. And Iran has said consistently that it does not want to have nuclear weapons. It would like to have nuclear power, but that it doesn't intend to create a nuclear weapon. And this is just another piece of evidence that supports what Iran is saying, that it voted for this nuclear ban treaty. Countries who ratified the treaty are basically saying that they will not build nuclear weapons or participate in nuclear weapons in any way. The United States, in response to the ratification of the nuclear ban treaty, is pushing back against countries and trying to convince them to take their ratification back. Japan is one country that has actually experienced nuclear weapons, and they have declined to ratify the nuclear ban treaty, and they cite the reason as being their relationship with the United States and not wanting to jeopardize that. But there is a strong movement in Japan pushing for them to participate in this treaty. And this treaty is important because it starts to establish in international law that nuclear weapons are illegal, and people are hoping that they can push more countries, particularly the nuclear states, to join onto this treaty. Now, there is some good news on the current nuclear treaties. Russia recently offered an extension on the New START treaty, which limits the number of nuclear weapons, and that is set to expire in February of 2021. There's also the non-proliferation treaty that is coming up for renegotiation next year. There have been a number of victories against fossil fuel infrastructure projects. East Pittsburgh stopped a fracking well from being drilled there. The community mobilized and pushed back and stopped that fracking well. Congratulations to them. Also in Newark, New Jersey, the New Jersey Transit Company was getting ready to, or was applying to be able to build a gas power plant. And the community pushed back and said, no, we don't want a gas power plant. We want renewable energy. They have been successful now, and New Jersey Transit has said they will not build that gas power plant, and they are currently looking into renewable energy sources. I'm sure activists there know that it's important to see what those forms of energy are, because not everything that's called renewable or clean energy actually is renewable or clean energy, but that's a victory there for New Jersey. And then the Mountain Valley Pipeline seems to be in a stalled phase. There's a section of it that has a stop work order, and it's currently right now in the courts deciding how much of a buffer zone needs to be around that area. So activists are hoping that with the stoppage of the Atlantic Coast Pipeline, the fact that oil and gas companies are really struggling right now, and that renewable clean energy is becoming so inexpensive, that they're hoping that they can stall the Mountain Valley Pipeline long enough that it won't be completed. Another victory is that a federal judge ruled that prisoners can receive their stimulus checks. Initially, the IRS was giving stimulus checks to prisoners, and then they just stopped sending them. And so a group of prisoners sued them over that, and the court found that it was an arbitrary decision by the IRS and that they need to reinstate sending those checks. However, prisoners are facing obstacles from the Bureau of Prisons. They're not able to receive the email information that they need, the forms that they need to fill out, have access to printers and those types of things. And so lawyers and activists are continuing to push to make sure that the Bureau of Prisons provides them with those things. There's also groups that are sending the materials to the prisoners to make sure that they can get those and apply for those checks. Another victory was a federal judge ruling that the United States Postal Service must reassemble its mail sorting machines. And of course, these were started to be taken offline in July of this year when the new Postmaster General, Louis DeJoy, ordered that a number of these machines be taken offline. And there was a lawsuit filed by New York State and other cities and states that joined into that, which was successful. And as I said, the federal judges ruled that they need to be reassembled. This was really focusing on the need to have capacity of sorting machines for the upcoming election. But there's a lot of concern that those sorting machines may not be completely reassembled in time for the election. They were really literally taken completely apart, and in some cases, pieces of them were used to repair other machines. So we'll see how that goes. Chile had a major victory on Sunday when they voted overwhelmingly to have a new constitution. Almost 80% of the population in Chile, and more than 80% of the population living outside of the country but who voted, supported a new constitution, and that means that they will now form a constitutional assembly to write it. The current constitution was written during the era of Augusto Pinochet, which many people are probably familiar with. On September 11th, 1973, in a U.S.-backed coup, the government of Salvador Allende was overthrown and Pinochet was put in power. And that unleashed an era of neoliberalism and violence, austerity. There were disappearances of people and murders of people, really a brutal period in Chile's history. And over the past year, Chileans have been protesting against the neoliberalism in their country, and they just actually celebrated their one-year anniversary of those protests this month. And so the hope is that the new constitution can be one that more meets the needs of the people of Chile. Activist groups there know that they need to remain vigilant through this process and make sure that it goes smoothly and that the government is doing what it's required to do to write that new constitution. Protests have been going on in Nigeria throughout this month against the Special Anti-Robbery Squad, or SARS, a group of police that has been acting with impunity and has been very violent. In fact, the campaign against SARS started in 2017 when groups started complaining about the human rights violations. But in early October, protests took off because of a killing of a young man by the SARS unit that was videotaped, and people saw that. And so this protest is really very organic. It's not led by organizations. It's very youth-led. They've been very persistent in spite of the fact that they are facing real repression and violence against the protesters by the police and military. 62 people have been killed, and currently in Lagos, a curfew has been put into effect to try to stop the protests. Two organizations in the United States, the Pan-African Community Action and Black Alliance for Peace, have put out a statement pointing out the relationship between the Nigerian police and military and the United States. Police in Nigeria are trained through the International Police Training School, which is dominated by the United States. And the U.S. has a strong presence in Africa through its Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which has a relationship with the military. PACA and BAP point out that this relationship is one of neo-colonialism, where the United States trains the police and military in these techniques to make sure that there isn't any rising up against governments that are allies of the United States. The Nigerian protests are receiving a huge amount of international solidarity with actions around the world, particularly at Nigerian embassies in various countries. Another issue that's receiving a lot of global solidarity is focused on the Palestinian prisoner, Mar al-Akras. He was initially detained. He's not been charged with any crime. He's under administrative detention that began on July 27th of this year. And he's been on a hunger strike from the first day of his detention. He's now more than 90 days into that hunger strike. His health is poor. He's in serious condition in a hospital. And lawyers and the public are pushing for him to be released. And Israeli government is refusing to do that. So now his family has started a hunger strike in solidarity with him. And they're calling for a global hunger strike on October 28th. Groups around the United States are also planning major protests beginning on November 4th, the day after the presidential election. No matter who wins this presidential election, we know that the people will lose because things are not going to change in any significant way. You know, we're facing these current crises now of the pandemic is, you know, out of control. The recession is likely to be a long-term depression. Congress is failing to take appropriate action to do what's needed to make sure that people can get through this pandemic and recession without losing their homes, without losing their financial security, able to get health care, able to make sure they have food and that their children can get a safe and appropriate education. And then on top of that, we were experiencing the climate crisis, you know, with fires on the west and in Colorado, with flooding going on, the hurricanes in the south. So a lot that's going on right now. And, you know, this is going to continue until we actually get out there and make serious demands, because this is a choice of the government to not do these things. They could meet our needs. They could bail out the people. They could put in place a national improved Medicare for all healthcare system in a very short time. So it's good to see that there are various groups out there organizing locally, also national groups calling for actions. And they're calling for all kinds of things, including general strikes, walkouts, boycotts, not paying rent. So there's a lot of different ways that people can participate in these protests. And as we see in Latin America with these recent victories in Chile, in Bolivia, where they overthrew a U.S.-backed coup, that when people organize around a bold vision, they can win. So with that being said, what I'd like to do, as this is the last week before the presidential election, I'd like to play a clip from a talk that was given by Kevin Zeese, the former co-host of Clearing the Fog. This is the last public speech that he made before his death on September 6th. And he really speaks to the power of the people and what our attitude should be in this election. And this was from a event called Keep It in the Streets that happened on, it was an online webinar and rally that happened on August 30th. So I'll play that clip.
The next person up to speak is going to be my friend, Kevin Zeese, and a embassy protector who I'm happy to say was able to beat the charges protecting the Venezuelan embassy in DC. So Kevin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And I just want to say from the beginning, power to the people. We have the power to make the change if we stay united. We have incredible opportunity now. We see the movements growing, and we see now for all this, all clear to see, especially after the DNC and RNC, the convention showed us that those parties do not represent the people, that our power is not in elections. Our power is building people power, and we see that happening. We need to build power so that in 2021, the people can rule from below, so we can call general strikes, so we can stop business as usual. We need to be able to make our country ungovernable so our demands are heard and met. That is the only way change will occur. It will not come from Joe Biden or Donald Trump. It will come from the people. We have to understand, and this is often very hard for people to understand, but the only path to success is failure. We fail and fail and fail until we win. But every time we try, we build the movement and we get stronger. We can never tell how close we are to success. It's like we're banging on a wall, pounding and pounding. And it's not till that wall begins to crack that we start to see the light come through and we realize we're getting close to that breakthrough moment when change can occur. We see the 2020s as a decade of transformation. The movements have been growing since Occupy in 2011, and then the Black Lives Matter movement, the Fight for 15, all during the Obama era and the growing of the movements in the Trump era. We see the 2020s as a decade of social transformation. In order to have that transformation succeed, we need to be organized and educated. In the chat box, you see a link to our movement school, How Social Transformation Occurs. That's popularresistance.org/school. It's a free school where you can learn how movements grow, how they develop, the various stages of movements, and how it's normal for us to not always be on a linear path to success, but it's a jagged path, and we move up and we get stronger. We all know that Donald Trump is terrible, worst president of my life. His overt racism, his open support for violent white supremacists, his mishandling of the COVID-19 virus, causing more than 180,000 deaths so far, probably more than 200,000 by the time we get to the election. His poor response to the economic collapse is leading us into another Great Depression. And he consistently puts in place laws for the wealthy while poverty, homelessness, debt, and joblessness increase. But Biden is no better. And I mean no better. For 47 years, he's been wrong on every important issue. My career began when I was in college, going to a anti-racism demonstration in Boston in favor of school integration. At that time, Biden opposed school integration. Then I worked on ending mass incarceration, ending the drug war, while Biden was passing laws to escalate the drug war, passing laws of mandatory sentencing to increase mass incarceration. He's the architect of mass incarceration. Then later in his career, when he became chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he led the effort, not just voting for the Iraq war, but leading the effort to make the Iraq war happen and every other war. As chair of foreign relations, he put in place massive military budgets, bloated, corrupt budgets, while leading us into war after war. And then when it came to student bankruptcy, he led the effort to make it so students can't get rid of school debt, even in bankruptcy. And now he's even calling for cutting Social Security when we should be doubling or even tripling Social Security payments. So I'm going to vote against Trump by voting for what I believe in. There are more alternatives than the two parties. I'll be voting Green candidates Howie Hawkins and Angela Walker because I'm going to be voting for Medicare for All. I'm going to be voting for community control of police, for the eco-socialist Green New Deal, for ending the wealth divide and ending the never-ending wars. We all have the power to vote for what we believe in. Candidates reflect the movement. There are many more choices than the two corrupt candidates of the millionaires. And we need to use the elections, the little power we have in the elections, to send a message for what we are for, to show that those who speak for movement issues get the movement's support. After we vote, we must build people power so that people can rule from below. We must build people power so that no matter who's in office, we can stop the government from operating. We can make the country ungovernable. We can put in place general strikes so that our demands are heard and met. That is how we will win. We have a lot to build on, from the Occupy movement in 2011 through to Black Lives Matter and Fight for 15 and the current uprisings today. There have been over 900 wildcat strikes since March. The labor movement is going. The climate justice movement is going. The anti-racist movement is going. The anti-inequality movement is going. We have a lot to build on. The 1% cannot defeat the 99% if we are organized. So don't underestimate ourselves. We can stop this issue. We can make the change we want. Power to the people. Thank you all for being here.
So that's all I have time for. I'll take a short musical break, and then we'll be right back with the interview with Gabriel Rockhill.
I'll tell all you fascists you may be surprised. Cause the people around this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. Hey, all you fascists, you're bound to lose. Hey, all you fascists. Hey, all you fascists. Hey, all you fascists, you're bound to lose. You're bound to Well, tell all you fascists you may be surprised. People around this world are getting organized. You're bound to lose. Yeah, fascists, you're bound.
To Clearing the Fog, Speaking Truth to Expose the Forces of Greed with Margaret Flowers. And now I turn to my guest, Gabriel Rockhill. He's a Franco-American philosopher, a cultural critic, and an activist. He's associate professor at Villanova University, an author, and founder and executive director of the Critical Theory Workshop. Thank you for taking time to speak with me today, Gabriel.
Thanks for having me on.
So you've written a series of four articles this month. Three of them were published in Counterpunch and the fourth one in Black Agenda Report about fascism and liberalism and capitalism. Can you first tell our listeners, you know, why are we talking about this right now?
Well, I think the timing was important because, as one great thinker once claimed, the oppressed are allowed once every few years to decide which particular representatives of the oppressing class are to represent and repress them for the next few years. And the news news cycle as well as social media has been so dominated by the upcoming election, as honestly it always is for years in advance, that there has been very little discussion of the deeper history of the system of political liberalism, how it actually functions, what its historical relationship to fascism has been. And so I wanted to bring that deeper history up to the forefront of contemporary discussions, in particular because there's a lot of misunderstandings about, you know, what exactly fascism is, what exactly liberalism is, and more specifically, how to struggle against rather pernicious forces that are, you know, racist, misogynist, colonialist, and pro-capitalist, of course. And so that was the main impetus for structuring the articles and publishing them this month in the lead up to the election. But then I was also interested in the ways in which the current debate frames everything in terms of a misapprehension of the historical relationship between what's called the right and the left, and that this is just a result of ideological drift over the last decades and even more than that. And there's a misrecognition of the forces that have actually fought and won against fascism historically due to a kind of mythological history of the United States and what I refer to in one of the articles as the founding myth of contemporary Euro-American world. And that is that this world was constituted by defeating fascism and establishing a global liberal order, which, as I show through, you know, some material detail, is a false narrative.
Yeah, we are such a distracted and mythologized culture in the United States. I really appreciated these articles because I think they do lay it out really clearly. And I hope that in this program, we'll be able to kind of lay it out pretty clearly for the listeners. You talk about in the first article, Fascism, Now You See It, Now You Don't, about fascist exceptionalism and how people really look at the German and Italian models of fascism and think, well, that's what fascism looks like. And if we don't see that here, then we must not be fascist. Can you talk about kind of what fascism is?
Yeah, well, I guess there's two parts to your question, right? One is this ideology of fascist exceptionalism, which consists in saying that fascism only occurred at one point in history in one location. You know, most people identify it with Italy and then Germany, and then it was wiped out or eradicated due to the US intervention in World War II. And so there's an entire industry, of course, built around that, and vast, vast cultural industries that are constantly telling us that the supreme evil of Nazism was defeated by, you know, American patriotism and American investment in freedom and other such things. And that really distorts the history of actually existing fascism and how it's operated. And so the second aspect of this is a bit complex in order to get all of the different dimensions on the board, but I would say a few things. One is that it is incorrect to assume that fascism emerged, even in the European case that most people refer to as classical fascism, as somehow a break with liberal order. Both Mussolini and Hitler, as I demonstrate in the article, rose to power through the mechanisms of parliamentary democracy, and more specifically bourgeois democracy. Of course, what I mean by that is a democracy that has, or purported democracy more correctly, that has been established by a ruling class that has also set up certain protocols to ensure that anyone who gets through that system has the green light of the ruling class. And in the case of both Mussolini and Hitler, they had enormous financial backers, not only within Germany and within Italy, but also multinational corporations, and more specifically American corporations, Henry Ford and the Ford Corporation being perhaps the most well-known, but there were many others. And so there was a lot of money and support funneled into the rise of fascism within the European context. And so classical fascism really needs to be situated in the conjuncture of early 20th century capitalism and the world historical crisis of capitalism at that point in time. So a few other factors that, of course, are important for the rise of so-called classical fascism is the success of the first workers' revolution in the Soviet Union in 1917, which began slowly but surely to build a system that was an alternative to the capitalist system and was seen, of course, as an enormous threat to the ruling classes and the ruling cliques of the so-called Western world. But another was the deep financial depression of the 1930s that demonstrated to the masses of people around the world that the capitalist system was not only crisis prone, but that it could plummet workers into abysmal conditions. And so what was recognized, of course, that with the contrast between what was going on in the depression-ridden capitalist world and the successful rise of the first workers' revolution in the Soviet Union, was that the stakes were very high in global class struggle, and there needed to be a solution to that. And in many ways, that solution was fascist. It's what Michael Parenti refers to as the final solution to class struggle. When capitalist systems are really under threat, there's a resolute workers' movement, there's the possibility of really developing socialist, you know, revolutions. Of course, this was a threat in Germany in 1919. And the reaction to that then is, you know, what people have theorized under the label of classical fascism, you know, in short, taking the money of transnational capital and more specifically industrial capital, so big capital, those who had a vested interest in the permanent war economy, and then mobilizing sectors of the, particularly this, the petty bourgeoisie, to create parastate forms of violence to destroy workers' movements and attempt to usher in then what ended up being at the beginning parties that were condoned by the liberal apparatus, or at least had the, you know, some legitimacy within the apparatus of the bourgeois democracies.
I really like the way that you talk about fascism and liberalism as like the good cop or bad cop, good cop of protecting capitalism. Can you expand on, you know, what you mean by that?
Yeah, I might just begin by sometimes when people, particularly in the rather provincial setting of U.S. politics, hear the term liberalism, they think, oh, this is like liberals who are kind of lefties who vote for the Democratic Party. That's not what I'm talking about. And that, you know, these liberals then would be juxtaposed to conservatives, and the choice would be between you vote Democratic or you vote Republican. The system of political liberalism historically emerged, you know, it can be traced back to the 17th century and then really came into full force in the 18th and 19th centuries. And this was a system that purported to establish a neutral state apparatus, right, that wasn't, at least in principle, of course, in fact, it was different, aligned on a particular religious set of beliefs or a racial group or a gendered group or an economic group, but neutral in principle. And this governmental apparatus was going to oversee and protect the rights of all citizens equally, right? So when you have the founding of the US Republic and other modern republics, these emerged under the political philosophy and practice of political liberalism in this sense. So that means that both liberals and conservatives in the restricted American sense operate within this overall system of political liberalism. And one of the things that's quite extraordinary about the history of political liberalism, and that those who believe in this system have a lot of trouble seeing, is that it has, of course, gone hand in hand with the most rapacious and genocidal forms of global capitalism, including the decimation of indigenous populations, the enslavement of African populations, the exclusion of women, workers, indentured servants from real political power, or even, you know, any economic power that would allow them to maintain a livelihood and develop that power over time. And that the history of political liberalism is not a history of a system that is good in principle and then just has contradicted itself through practice and can be inscribed in a progress narrative, which is what a lot of liberal ideology would like to hoodwink us into believing. But instead, it's a system that has always been premised on doing one thing and saying another. You know, the great Aimé Césaire, drawing on the work of Toussaint Louverture, who was the leader of, or one of the leaders of the Haitian Revolution, had pointed out that in the Haitian Declaration of Independence, one of the things that the Haitians claimed was that we have been more oppressed by the lying words and hypocrisy of the French than by their armies. Right. And those lying words and hypocrisies is how the system of political liberalism has historically functioned and continues to function. In that regard, when classical fascism, so-called, emerged in the early 20th century. As I mentioned before, it emerged within the system of political liberalism because the system is not and has never been a bulwark against fascism. And so another part of this story that is extremely important to trace out is that classical fascism, as it's defined and as it was kind of codified and theorized, really just emerged as a set of parastate violent practices to crush worker movements in Italy, and was only theorized retrospectively and retroactively by Mussolini and others. It wasn't a doctrine and then became a practice. It was an activity, and then people tried to theorize it. So it's a very loose set of practices, and there's no real central coherent generic concept of fascism. But what's important about these practices is that they have a much deeper history than the early 20th century, right? They are linked back to, as Aimé Césaire, Domenico Lasordo, and other very important intellectuals, historians, and philosophers have pointed out, to the deep history of colonialism. Césaire, of course, famously claimed that people only speak of fascism when concentration camps are built in Europe, when they've been being built around the world in the entire history of colonialism. And so one of the reasons that I highlight this and bring this to the fore is it depends on how exactly you want to define fascism, because it's not as if there's a generic pre-given concept, but if you scale out from the interwar period and look at the deeper history of state and parastate violence that has been mobilized in order to impose capitalist social relations, then you need to recognize that these fascist forces have their roots in the colonial violence and what many people refer to as primitive accumulation of capitalism.
Right. And if I can recap what I'm hearing you saying, then kind of it's the system of a liberal democracy that leads people to believe that they're actually living in a state where they have a choice, or, you know, that, and living in kind of a very propagandized state. You know, I think of, I fought for a long time and still do for a universal healthcare system. And I was fighting really hard in 2009, 2010 against what the presidential administration was doing, where they were telling people, oh, we're giving you healthcare as a human right. And it was really clear to me that what they were giving us was a healthcare system that would further enrich the medical industrial complex.
100%.
Yeah, but so many people fell for that. And so you call this kind of fascism, liberalism myth, you know, that these are polar opposites, as a false antagonism, and how they both support capitalism. But when liberal democracy doesn't work to, and, you know, to hold up capitalism, then they revert to more fascist types of tactics of suppressing those who would be fighting against what they're doing.
Exactly. Yeah, no, exactly. And I'm sorry, I didn't fully come to the question that you raised, which is theorizing liberalism and fascism ultimately as the good cop and bad cop of capitalism. And what you say is absolutely correct, that liberalism historically has functioned as the good cop who says to the general population, you are free and equal before the law, we rule in your best interest, we are accountable to popular power, and all of the other myths that we have about American so-called democracy. I would just qualify that the United States was not founded as a democracy. It was founded as an anti-democratic republic, and it never transformed its institutional framework of power from a republic, which is basically an elite form of oligarchic and plutocratic rule, into truly democratic institutions. But that's a bit of a side point. So the good cop is the one who's trying to hoodwink us into believing in the system. And that is very beneficial to the capitalist ruling class, because they can rule by consent, right? It's very easy to rule over people if people believe in that system, as you just pointed out quite poignantly, with the case of privatized health insurance that excluded single payer options and didn't bring in the possibility of, you know, basically the forms of healthcare systems that we have in more or less every other industrialized country in the world. And the bad cop of fascism functions as a form of state and or parastate violence. So parastate just being, you know, vigilante violence, organized crime that is allowed to occur by the state because it's in the interests of the capitalist ruling class that controls the state apparatus. And one of the things that you said is absolutely correct, that when liberal rule breaks down and is insufficient for maintaining capitalist social relations, you can rest assured that the liberal good cop is going to tap out and the fascist bad cop is going to come in and get the job done by any means necessary. And we've seen innumerable cases of that, right? So there can be shifts over time, right, from the good cop to kind of bad cop rule. But the other thing that I insist on in these articles is a kind of paradigm shift for how we understand governance in particular states, but also then internationally. And that is that in each individual state that declares itself to be liberal, there are different modes of governance that are used to target specific populations. So in the first article, I draw on the brilliant work of George Jackson, who pointed out all of the similarities between so-called classical fascism in Germany and Italy and what was going on before his eyes in the United States in the state and parastate class and racial war on Black people, on racialized minorities in general, on poor people across the board. And his conclusion was that fascism is alive and well in the United States insofar as it targets these specific populations. So one result of this, just to kind of come full circle, is that if the United States is currently a self-declared liberal, representative, I would say pseudo-democracy, then at the same time, it constantly supports and allows to have free rein various forms of violence that I think can only be described as fascist when it's about crushing radical social movements, destroying anti-racist movements, detaining and basically subjecting to various forms of torture, so-called immigrant populations, all of these, the mass incarceration system. We could go on with a very long list of the forms of fascistic population control that are alive and well and operative within the United States. And that's not even mentioning the foreign policy, which of course we could say a lot about.
Right. Yeah. I was thinking while you were talking that one like small example that was recent that my listeners would be familiar with is last year when I and a group of other people stayed inside of the Venezuelan embassy in Washington, D.C. for 37 days to prevent the U.S. from handing it over to a coup government. And initially, you know, the State Department couldn't figure out what to do because we were there with the permission of the Venezuelan government. We had the keys to the building. We didn't break in and we were allowed to go freely in and out while they were trying to figure out how they were going to get us out of there. And what they ultimately did was they just brought this like hordes of violent regime change agents that were working with the State Department, law enforcement, DC law enforcement, to try to terrorize us out of the building and just subjected us to, you know, noise all day and lights in our eyes and threats and breaking in and assaulting the people on the outside that were supporting us while the police watched them do that.
Yeah, exactly. And then not, well, hats off to you for supporting the Venezuelan struggle and people's right to self-determination.
Right.
But then also cutting off food, right? I wasn't there personally, but I had a lot of...
They cut off our water, our power, our food, everything. And yeah, exactly. And it's like that was just like a very small example of kind of what we're talking about on a much bigger scale. But I'm really glad that you brought up that the U.S. is not a democracy, was not founded as a democracy, because there actually was a democratic movement alive in the U.S. before the revolution. And then the oligarchs came in to crush that with it and wrote this property-based constitution. But more recently, I want to get into kind of what's been happening over the past like century in the United States and really accelerating over maybe the last half century. As you talked about kind of this fascist creep that's been happening in the United States. Because when you look at what happened in Italy and what's happening now, there's a lot of parallels. And I think you mentioned some of them, but can we talk a little bit about how that corporate control, capitalist control has developed over the past century or half century?
Yeah, it's a big question.
Yeah.
But I could certainly take a stab at at some fundamental features, right? One is that in the early 20th century, and again, I point this out in the articles in some detail, the model for the racial police state in Nazi Germany, as well as the colonial rampage to the east, was the United States. And this is made very clear in, you know, Nazi documents, Nazi law, but then also Hitler's writings And so there was a recognition that the state that it was at, what was at the cutting edge of class racial warfare was the United States. And that's an important part of this history because of the, you know, the connections between the so-called classical fascism and the attempt to make it exceptional and cut it off from the history of the United States. In fact, you know, many people recognized in Mussolini's Black Shirts a kind of Italian version of the Ku Klux Klan, which were a vigilante organization including about 5 million participants that were allowed to act largely with impunity in order to enforce the racial capitalist police state of the United States. And then when you begin to trace that out through the course of the long 20th century, you have a continuation of various forms, you know, various organizations that are white supremacist, that are fascist, that are ethno-nationalist, that are allowed to operate based on the principle of liberal tolerance, which has always been something that's quite remarkable, right? The liberals love to be tolerant of fascists, but of course they waged a war against communists and were, you know, fine with saying there was a communist conspiracy and that communists should be eradicated. They don't have the right to teach in universities. They should be chased out of the country and other such things. And so the roots of a lot of the organizations, the contemporary organizations that are vigilante and fascist organizations, of course, go back to this interwar period. And then the other part of the equation that's very important is the U.S. global hegemony that was established in particular in the post-World War II era was a moment of the reorganization of the world order in which, you know, just since the World War II, the U.S. has endeavored to overthrow some 50 foreign governments, the majority of which were democratically elected. And this went hand in hand with meddling in dozens and dozens of elections, direct assassination campaigns, and other such things. So one of the ways in which US-style capitalism was slowly but surely imposed globally was through the use of fascist forces. And, you know, I'm kind of going quick and summing up a lot of things here, but one of the other elements is the redeployment of Nazis and fascists from Germany and Italy in what I refer to as the Fascist International, which was driven by the deep state and the, what people call the invisible government. So the national security apparatus of the United States, which hired and redeployed an enormous number of Nazis and fascists in this global war on communism and a war to impose capitalist social relations around the globe.
Right. And I really recommend that people, read all four of your articles, but the one that's called The U.S. Did Not Defeat Fascism in World War II, it discreetly internationalized it. I think that's really important reading for people to understand just how those tentacles have reached out through the entire world. And that still happens today. And it really is about capitalism versus socialism. And we see the United States going after countries, you know, like Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba. You know, recently Bolivia had a victory that was very critical, but you know, it's continuing today. So right now we're in a moment in the United States where we're really in crisis in every sense of the word. You know, there's the climate crisis is raging. We're going into a depression. We've got this health crisis when millions of people are losing their health insurance. We have a Trump on one hand and a Biden on the other, and people are really focused on the election. What would you say to folks right now in terms of like of this election in the bigger context of what's going on and where we should be focusing our energies and our struggle?
Yeah, I would say two things. One is that you're absolutely right regarding just the global war on socialism. We have never had a single experiment in the history of the world in which socialism was allowed to freely establish itself. We have only ever had socialism under siege by imperial capitalist interests. And that is a very important thing to know. But more specifically regarding your question concerning the election is that one of the things that the major media conglomerates, which are of course just corporations that work for the ruling class, are hell-bent on convincing the general population of is that all that matters right now is the kind of 60-second pseudo-democracy of an election. And what that does is it reduces people's political agency to ballots that in certain cases might not even matter and probably will not matter. which is not to say that, you know, there are and have been historically certain ways in which elections can be important and their, you know, participating in them can be significant and lead to certain, you know, gains in various ways, but it reduces people's political agency to really 60 seconds every 2 to 4 years. And that is one of the deep problems with American political culture, is that there's not a recognition that politics is something that goes on 24/7, and that what you do in your daily life, the organizations that you're involved with, the things that you are doing in communicating with others and educating others and sharing resources and things like this, this is all part of the transformation of political culture. And ceding that power, giving up on that power and putting everything on an election between two members of the ruling class, both of whom have horrific records on many, many fronts, is misrecognizing the true political struggle. The true political struggle has always historically been between, I shouldn't say always, it has been in the recent centuries, been between a capitalist system that puts forth, in the case at least of elections, you know, technocrats who are going to execute capitalist policies in various ways, and that system of capitalism is crisis-ridden, it's bad for the global population, and it is also destroying the biosphere at an unprecedented pace. That is juxtaposed to, and needs to be juxtaposed to, socialism, which is a system in which people have real political power that they develop from the bottom up, and that is driven through organizations, political parties, unions, and other such things. And that is the only real way of developing, you know, not only real power, but hope for the future. The ruling class has never in any case allowed itself to be elected out of office, and it will not. It will call in the bad cop. There are instances of this, of course, of fascism. And so we need to spend time developing, and of course there already are a lot of very important organizations and parties within the United States, develop that power on the socialist left as the true bulwark against global capitalism and both of its cops, both the good cop of liberalism and the bad cop of fascism.
Right, because no matter, you know, who is elected this November, we're going to be facing really the same situation. I think it's hard for people to understand that. You know, I was very involved in organizing the Occupy movement, and look how the Obama-Biden administration went after the Occupy movement and broke that up. And I think, you know, Biden has already declared openly a war on the poor. He said, if you bring Medicare for All to my desk, I will veto it. I do not support the Green New Deal. You know, it's like, it couldn't be more blatant. So,
and an imperialist, right? And
absolutely.
Long imperialist record. Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And you know, and also an architect of mass incarceration and the drug war, and, you know, the architect of the student debt crisis as well. And going after China, you know, is, you know, trying to compete with Trump on who's tougher on China. Yeah.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. 100%. I mean, one question that I have, and I don't have an answer to this, but I do sometimes wonder if the transnational capitalist class, like the ruling figures, of whom there are, you know, very few because of the global wealth distribution, actually see in Biden a solution to certain problems. Because in the case of a Biden election, post-election, I would imagine that a lot of those who are invested in a kind of liberal form of political organizing will no longer be in the streets or contributing to social movements. They'll consider this a win. There'll be an uptick in the, you know, imperialist endeavors. It'll be kind of providing the liberal cover for the very rapacious forms of neoliberal capitalism that have been going on for decades now, and would raise some very, very serious problems, which is not to say that if Trump were elected, there wouldn't be, you know, similar problems, you know, slightly different problems as well, due to his support of so many, you know, fascist oriented vigilante forms of violence and other such things. But we should have absolutely no illusions about this. And the way in which the mass media and the pseudo-intelligentsia has browbeaten people into only focusing on the election, and then miraculously trying to make Biden into a bulwark against some of the, you know, worst forms of capitalist depredation, is, you know, it is honestly just quite laughable. These are two enemies of the people and should be identified as such. And we need to be organizing and building power for socialist movements of a radical sort, because the clock is ticking and capitalism is destroying the conditions of possibility of life.
Well said. Absolutely. Well, Gabriel, I really appreciate you taking time to speak with me today. And I encourage people to follow your writing. Where's the best place to follow you?
I have a lot of my writings on my website, gabrielrockhill.com. That might be the most centralized hub. But otherwise, you know, I am on Twitter and on Facebook, at least intermittently.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
Well, that's all for today. I'll go out with a song by Junkyard Empire. It's called We Want.
We'll lift our brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love.